When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Colin Elliott about his book, Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World, published by Princeton University Press. This book, I think, is absolutely fascinating. If you are someone who already is interested in sort of ancient Roman things, this is kind of an obvious bet that you will find this interesting. But even if you're not, this book takes us right back to the middle of the second century AD and helps us understand what very well might be the first pandemic, and all the things that kind of led to it, what actually happened, what some of the impacts were. So there's so much to get into here. Colin, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolute pleasure to be with you, Miranda.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself and explain why this book?
Sure. So I'm a historian at Indiana University in the United States. I enjoy researching and teaching my students about the Roman economy, about the monetary economy, but I also have lately been interested in disease. I was interested in disease, by the way, before it was cool. But around the time that it became cool, in 2020, I just got asked to write a book. I was already doing some research on this ancient pandemic in the second century AD called the Antonine Plague. And the publisher of what would become Pax Romana just reached out and said, hey, we'd heard you were working on this plague. We think this pandemic might be of interest to people. And I think everybody assumed that it would not last forever, as it ended up doing. And so anyway, the whole time I was writing a book on a pandemic, we were in the midst of a pandemic. As the book started taking shape, it became clear that I was hoping that the book would not just cover a pandemic because pandemics were of current interest, but that I would cover a pandemic in a historically careful and a thoughtful way, a way in which would respect the fact that the Antonine Plague, at least the subject of the book, is a disease event that we know very little about. And it's not as though a boatload of new evidence suddenly showed up when I wrote the book. So I wanted to be careful and respectful of the state of the evidence as it was. But I also wanted to write a book that would not overemphasize catastrophe. There are plenty of arguments that have been going around for the last several hundred years about how this, that, and the other destroyed the Roman Empire. And I did not want to write a book that simply put a pandemic in the kind of main character spot as for the destruction of the Roman Empire. So I just wanted to write a really careful, thoughtful book about the world's first pandemic. It's basically how it went.
Very straightforward task, but I think that belies the complexity of it. And in fact, I want to pick up on that point about kind of the evidence and information that we have. You talk about in the book that you think parents of small children might be particularly familiar with the kinds of problems raised by this source material. Why this population of all people would be familiar with it? So what is that problem and how do you approach it?
Yeah. So towards the end of the introduction of the book, I mentioned this comment that parents of small children can in some ways understand what historians have to do with a mysterious disease event like the Antonine Plague. The fact is, if I go into my cupboard right now where my children keep all of the games, and we'll probably play a board game in the next few nights, I'll go to grab the board game, I'll take it out, and what I'll find is about 80% of the pieces to that game that I've pulled out. But then I'm also going to find some other things in there. I'm probably going to find some Lego. I'm going to find some pieces from other games or maybe some puzzle pieces. I'm going to find some probably old bits of food in there as well. I mean, who knows what I'm going to find? Anytime, you know, it's like it's an adventure every time you open a box to play a game or grab a puzzle at my house. And the Antonine Plague is like that. The Antonine Plague is a disease event which clearly had a big effect on the Roman Empire, but the sources are really quite challenging because the direct sources for the Antonine Plague are very difficult to understand. They're exaggerated, or sometimes one author is trying to say something really bad about a ruler or something like that, and so their information is actually a little bit suspect when it comes down to what actually happened with the plague. And then on the other hand, there are some bits of evidence that really look like they might be related to this pandemic. But when it comes down to it, if you really poke at them and look at them in a very close way, maybe not so much. And so it is just a really challenging pandemic to understand, in that you've got this evidence that looks really, really good that maybe isn't, and you have some evidence that may not even seem at all like it's relevant to the Antonine Plague, and in fact, it is. And so the book really tries to carefully examine each piece, to really sort out the cupboard of games and puzzle boxes, which obviously parents try to do. It's a futile attempt in some ways, but I think the book in the end really gives a more complete and more nuanced picture of the Antonine Plague than we've ever had. And in some ways, obviously, a more complete picture of the end of this period called the Pax Romana than we have had.
Hmm. I think that last point is particularly apt, because lest readers get any misapprehensions, this book doesn't just say, okay, here's a plague, what happened on day one, right? It's really looking at the world that we're in, the systems that we're in, and kind of what is happening around it. So I'd like to talk about one of those aspects to start off with. What did public health and sanitation look like in this Roman world before the plague? And what do we need to understand about the system in order to be able to figure out what happens once the plague arrives?
This is an important question because foundationally, the Antonine Plague does not hit a Roman Empire that is squeaky clean and, you know, was just sailing along and doing great. This is one of the big contentions of the book, is that even before the Antonine Plague struck the Roman world, the Roman Empire was a diseased and, frankly, a disgusting place, especially in the cities. So just, you know, on the small scale, anytime anyone would venture outside of their dwelling place and go onto a city street, whether it's in the city of Rome or it's in Pompeii or it's in some other, if it's in a city in Syria or a city in Gaul, they almost certainly, their first step, they had to be careful because they would likely step in a few inches worth of muck, mud, rotten food, feces, vomit, animal carcasses. This stuff was littered throughout the cities of the Roman Empire. If they were to take their first breath when they walked out of their dwelling place, they would have smelled the reek of kitchen fires, wood fires, oil lamps, ovens, you know. And if they thought, well, I'm already dirty, I've just taken one step out of my house and I'm already disgusting, what am I supposed to do? Then maybe they'd go to the bath. And we always think of baths as a thing that brings cleanliness, because of course, in many of our cases, it does. But in the Roman world, what we're talking about when we're thinking about a bath is a kind of stagnant urban pond. I mean, the water wasn't regularly filtered out. There were no chemicals. There was no chlorine in the bath. People would go there and wash the muck off the streets just like everybody else wanted to do. And that's the water in which they would wash in. They peed in their bathwater. They did all sorts of other things in their bathwater that would make it grow. So the Roman Empire, the cities of the Roman Empire in particular, are not in a good place in terms of public health, even before the Antonine Plague. And there are parasites in the population, bacteria, there are fecal oral diseases that crop up in the summer, and then respiratory viruses in the winter. And so what this means is the populations of these cities throughout the Roman world were weak, their bodies were racked, and they were in some ways sitting ducks for any kind of deadly and virulent novel virus that would find its way into the Roman Empire. So, and that's exactly what happened with the Antonine Plague.
Well, and if that isn't bad enough, because honestly, that sounds pretty gross.
It is.
And not like a great situation for a plague to come into. You talk about in the book, there is more. So what is the food crisis that's also brewing on this eve of pandemic?
Yeah, the Roman Empire, right before the Antonine Plague strikes, is in the Pax Romana, which sounds like it is the Roman peace. And that sounds like peace and prosperity, that everybody is doing very, very well. But we have to remember that this is a pre-industrial empire. It is dealing with the same kinds of food insecurities that any other pre-industrial society is dealing with. They just happen to have a few amphitheaters and bathhouses and imperial palaces that make it look a little bit better to our eyes. But in fact, Rome, just like any other pre-industrial empire, is dependent upon the agricultural economy. It's dependent upon human labor, slave labor in particular, and animal husbandry. It cannot entirely get away from that pre-industrial agricultural economic model. And so what that means is, for Rome, it's dependent upon the bread baskets in the Mediterranean. And it depends upon these through a tribute system. So Egypt and Sicily and North Africa in particular are the bread baskets of the Roman Empire. They can get grain from elsewhere, but those are principally the three big bread baskets. And what happens is around 150 AD or thereabouts, there are some subtle and relatively short-term changes in the climate. These are not catastrophes. This is not like a volcano erupts and darkens the sun for a year. There's nothing like that. This sort of thing does happen later on. It doesn't happen during the Antonine Plague. But we do have some good evidence to show, and I bring this up in the book, that there are some droughts in Egypt that are a little bit more severe than had previously occurred. There are increases in storm activity in the Mediterranean proper, even just in what kind of temperate Western and Central Europe. There seems to be a drought, a period of lower precipitation. And the locations of these things matter. So it's not as though, again, the whole northern hemisphere drops by 2 or 3 degrees Celsius. That's not what happens. But Egypt getting a drought for several decades, that is a big deal, because suddenly now the city of Rome, which Rome principally gets its grain from Egypt, is unable to feed its population very well. And the ships that are bringing grain from Egypt are more likely to face wrecks, and all, if not wrecks, then delays because of poor weather. The other kind of compensating agricultural areas in Northern Europe are also under some strain at the time. And so what that means is you get people that are flocking to the cities to try to get food, because there is a general food shortage just in terms of what's happening in the climate. And they're going to cities where the city supply, which gets its city, you know, where the cities, including Rome, are supplied from these bread baskets, they also are undersupplied. So you get migrations, you get a food crisis at the same time. And this, of course, further malnourishes people. So they're diseased already. They're dealing with the muck and the grossness and the inhaling the smoke. And now they're dealing with a food crisis about a decade or so prior to the Antonine Plague. So it really is a perfect storm of bad activity right before this pandemic strikes.
I know I've already asked you to add in an additional way in which we should be concerned, but I'm going to keep going on that
sure,
strand. let's throw some more into the picture. Can you tell us about Rome's economic and military power? Sounds like potentially a helpful thing. Actually, you talk about it in the book as being, quote, a crucial precondition for the pandemic.
Yeah. So initially with the Pax Romana, again, we associate that period of time with military and economic power. And it is. Rome's connectivity has never been better. You can sail across the Mediterranean in a matter of weeks. There are ships small that are making short trips. There are larger ships that are taking longer ships, carrying things like olive oil and wine and grain across the Mediterranean. So it's very well connected, both in kind of smaller short haul networks and long haul networks. And then beyond the Mediterranean, there are ships that are funneling through the Red Sea. They're leaving port in Egypt and they're going down the Red Sea and they're crossing the Indian Ocean. We even have one source from the court of the Han Chinese Emperor indicating that some so-called emissaries, they seem to be merchants really that got lost, but they called themselves emissaries, maybe they were worried about getting executed or, you know, accused of spies or something. Anyway, so they make it all the way to the court of the Han Emperor from Egypt. So my point just is the economic sprawl of the empire goes even beyond its borders. So highly connected economically, which in one sense is very, very good, right, for Rome's fortunes. The other area in which Rome is quite strong is with its military. So under the Emperor Hadrian, who took over in 117 AD, he really engages in a kind of retrenched military philosophy in which the legions are going to dig in and they're going to fortify the boundaries of the empire. Military is going to be drilled. And there's a period of peace in which this robust military is then able to essentially build roads, build fortifications, and enforce tax, import and export taxes, which they do. And those soldiers get flung even well beyond the Roman borders. So we have inscriptions that show Roman soldiers as far south as modern Yemen, the southern Arabian Peninsula. So this all looks like a great source of strength. But as your question gets to, because we now have merchants and trade caravans and soldiers, and in some cases, large groups of soldiers moving both within the Roman Empire across vast distances, but also into and out of the Roman Empire for various economic and military purposes. This, of course, makes it almost inevitable that some of these soldiers and merchants will find themselves encountering novel disease pathogens. And this almost certainly happens. We don't know how the Antonine Plague, for example, makes its way into the Roman Empire, but it's almost certainly going to have come in through either catching a ride with some traders or on a ship or in a military like a smaller group of soldiers that are moving back and forth, that sort of thing. So funnily enough, Rome's economic and military power were a vital precondition to actually introduce the disease into a world that was already weakened and essentially just waiting for it to strike. So you have everything. You have the dry tinder in the weakened population and the urban population, and then you have the spark, which would have been caused by this high degree of connectivity.
All right, so let's talk about the plague. What actually was it like? What sorts of symptoms are we talking about? How did it spread? How deadly was it? I mean, is that even a question we can answer?
Great. Yeah, I really appreciate that little caveat. After writing a book about the Antonine Plague, I feel no closer to being able to say it killed X number of people. But I think we can look at some of the symptoms, we can look at some of the places where it spreads, and we can make some educated guesses. So we know that the disease spread in cities. That's where the majority of our sources for the Antonine Plague come from, and we have really no significant evidence whatsoever of it spreading into the countryside. And in fact, even whole parts of the Roman Empire seem to have done just fine during the Antonine Plague. For example, in North Africa, we do not have much evidence that suggests that there was any kind of economic disruption at all, let alone a disruption caused by a new disease. But certainly this was not a nothing burger, as we might say. This is still a serious disease. The symptoms that are described by the Roman physician Galen are pretty serious. It sounds basically as though somebody would get a really high fever. They would have this fever for days on end. It would be difficult for them to eat because eventually they would develop sores and sensitivity in their throat. Some of them even coughing up ulcers and blood. Blood would also often show up in the stool. They would get, in some cases, pockmarks or pustules all over their body that would burst and then eventually scar over. Perhaps it depends on how we read his Greek. He uses a very unhelpful a word to describe the scarring, so it's very difficult to know if he's really saying scarring, but it seems like he might be saying scarring. Anyway, so it sounds a lot like a pox-like virus with pustules, and then, of course, many people died. We don't know the exact death rate. The symptoms are somewhat similar to smallpox, modern smallpox, which that disease kills about one third of its victims, at least in pre-industrial context. But we can know for sure that this disease was not exactly modern smallpox because we have the genetic evidence from that disease to show that it was only about 500 years old. It did not go back all the way back into classical antiquity, but perhaps some ancestor of smallpox or some similar pox-like virus must have been responsible. We don't know what it is. And like I said, as far as death toll, that's really tough too, because the sources go on and on about how deadly this thing was, but they use really vague language. Like they will just talk about legions being destroyed by the virus or cities being devoured by the virus. We don't know exactly, you know, does devoured mean 100% of the city? Does it mean 5% of the city? We don't really know. But assuming it affected the cities pretty badly, I mean, let's just, if half the population died, which seems like a wild overestimate, only about 20% of the population of the Roman Empire lived in cities. So we're not talking about, you know, half the Roman Empire dying. We're talking about, you know, maybe 15% of the Roman Empire dying. And I think that's probably on the upper limits of what is a responsible estimate for the death toll of this disease. Myself, I can't imagine this disease was nearly as deadly as, say, modern smallpox. There is evidence of disruption during the pandemic, but nothing to suggest that 15% of the population died. So I'm sure that we're looking at something closer to maybe 5% at most, which is not small. I mean, we're talking about 2 to 3 million people or so dying, but definitely a serious disease event, but not in and of itself a catastrophe. I mean, there are other things going on too, but certainly a plague that shook the Roman world, I think for sure, just to kind of use some flowery language, I guess, to talk about it.
Well, I think that gives us a good sense, right? And just because it doesn't kill everyone doesn't mean that it can't still have a big impact, especially
That's
in
right.
these kind of cramped urban conditions where, you know, we don't have statistics of it now. They didn't have them then, right? There was a
That's
lot
right.
of uncertainty and unknowns. And this very much comes through in how you talk about people reacting to this. So can you tell us a bit about that? Kind of how did this fit into conceptions of piety? How did this fit into understandings of new religions that were developing at this time, aka Christianity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really an important point to make. When we experienced our recent pandemic, we largely, I think, thought of it in terms of medicine and science, as we would in a society that places a high value on those things, and which sees disease phenomena as largely within the realm of science and medicine. That just seems obvious to us. Well, in the same way that we think of things with that framework and are so sure of it, the Romans would have seen this disease, and indeed really most diseases in a religious framework. And that would have just seemed obvious to them. How could you think of disease really in any other way? And so what we notice during the Antonine Plague is a serious reevaluation on the one hand of traditional religion, because if there is a disease, and just to be clear, nothing like this had really happened before, not just its deadliness or its particular symptoms. What is really significant about the Antonine Plague is that it is a pandemic. It did not simply strike a city or a region, but instead a Roman who fled from Smyrna in Asia Minor all the way over to Lugdunum in Gaul would have encountered the same disease, and that was unheard of. And so the idea that a disease could cover the entire world, as far as the Romans are concerned, suggests that some god or gods were truly furious, and arguably more furious than they had ever been. And so for the Romans, they're, and inhabitants of the Roman world, they are looking for a religious explanation for this. So part of what we see in the reaction is an attempt to placate traditional gods. So efforts to provide new, you know, inscriptions and statues in various cities. There's a whole slew of them in Asia Minor, especially to deities like Apollo and Artemis. These are deities that are associated with either causing diseases or healing diseases. So we get those sorts of things pressing into traditional religion. But there's also a lot of religious innovation. So there's this guy named Alexander who's running around Asia Minor, and he's got a pet snake that he claims is the reincarnation of the medical god Asclepius. And Asclepius has given him, through this snake, a incantation, like a new oracle that will ward off this plague that is, you know, affecting the entire world. And so there are people from Asia Minor all the way over to London that are taking Alexander's magic plague words and writing them on their doors or putting them on the gates of the city, or in one case, wearing them around an amulet. There was an amulet that was discovered in the foreshore of the Thames in London, which has got Alexander's plague ward scratched in a lead tablet. So the there are also these innovative reactions of trying to think about religion as in a new way. And then, as your question got to the third part of your question, there's the Christians. Now, we don't have they're kind of a wild card. We don't have a source that directly ties Christianity, either its success or its trials, with the Antonine Plague. But we have sources from this time which show Christians engaging in acts of charity. They're helping to deal with corpses. They are providing food to people who are struggling with the hunger during this period of food shortage. And of course, the Christians had been doing these sorts of activities in cities for more than 100 years at this point. So it's almost like they were ready. Without knowing, obviously, that the plague could come, they were essentially already institutionally doing the sorts of things that would at least help in a mild way mitigate or at least provide a sense of pro-social behavior during a plague. And so that had to help them. But of course, what hurt them is that they are still very much viewed as a strange, new, culty religion. And in the Roman concept of piety, the Christians are doing two things that are very wrong. Number one, they are worshiping the wrong deity. They are worshiping their god in very mysterious and strange ways. The Romans would accuse them, for example, of cannibalism, for eating the body and blood of Jesus. The Romans would accuse them of incest, for greeting one another with a holy kiss and yet calling each other brother and sister. So they're doing a lot of impious things, but then also they withdrew from a lot of the, at least some Christians, withdrew from a lot of the traditional religious rites in the Roman Empire. And this is the kind of thing that would make gods angry and would bring about disease. So it does seem like the persecution of Christians, and then at the same time, paradoxically, their success. Both of those things are ratcheting up during this pandemic. And I think the church does very, very well for itself in some ways from the years about 160 AD until about 190 AD, kind of the period of the pandemic and then its sort of immediate aftermath.
Very interesting. Thank you for adding that element in. And I think there's probably going to be a lot to think about just from that piece. But
yeah.
I'd like to move on to another piece, or in fact, I suppose, go back to something we've already discussed, the military and economic expansion of it all. Given how much that was, as you said, the spark that lit the tinder, how does the plague impact this?
So, as I mentioned before, with Hadrian, the Roman Empire had been in a period of fortress mentality, where there is an attempt to defend the boundaries, rebuild forts. Hadrian's Wall gets constructed under Hadrian. The Antonine Wall further north gets constructed under Antoninus Pius in the 150s. And there is generally a sense that Rome is going to be a fortress. Under Marcus Aurelius, right before the pandemic strikes, so in mid-160s, two sort of expansive wars are fought by the Romans. One in Persia, which is very, very successful, and that may be where the plague comes in. But then after the Persian War, Marcus and his co-emperor Lucius Verus attempt to wage a second war, this time on their northern boundary in Germania and some of the adjacent territories there across the Danube. And the idea here is perhaps even to make a new province eventually. Now, the problem is the pandemic strikes right before that war was supposed to happen in 166. So the pandemic hits Rome in 166, and Marcus and Lucius then cannot start their war. So they have another go in 168. They even take their military up to Aquileia, which is an Italian city in the north. It's sort of a natural staging ground to launch an aggressive war across the Danube. So they take tens of thousands of troops to Aquileia in 168. Both emperors go there. And then the plague hits there as well. There's a big outbreak there. And they flee to Rome. They can't start that war a second time. Third time's the charm, though. They finally are able to get the war started in the 170s. But at this point, the pandemic is raging, not just in Rome and Italy, but it has spread throughout a good chunk of, especially the northern part of the Roman Empire. And so the soldiers are dealing with not only just the normal dangers of war, you know, getting stabbed by some painted German, some long-haired German, but they also now have to deal with just random death from catching diseases. And of course, military camps are cramped. They are not necessarily very sanitary. And so there would have been plague all across the northern boundary of the empire. And this would have then made it very difficult to wrap up that war. In fact, Marcus, it seems, thought that this war was going to last maybe a year or two, and it ends up lasting the rest of his life. It would be a quagmire from which he would never quite escape. It would last a good 15 years or so, and really much beyond his life, because although a peace would be struck with the northern tribes after Marcus's death, that border would, from there on out, be a constant source of invasion, migration, and instability in the Roman Empire. So this impact from the Antonine Plague, this extra bit of death and chaos and randomness that it brought into that war, really has a substantial effect on the trajectory of Rome's foreign policy, especially with its northern border.
Foreign policy is not the only thing it impacts, though. And similarly, in terms of short and long-term impacts, tell us about the financial system of the Roman world.
This is a really important question because it pairs in so many ways with what's going on militarily and also with the food supply. What happens with soldiers is, as I said, they are dying from war and they are dying from plague. Well, similarly, workers. So those again, this is a novel disease, so it doesn't just strike children and the elderly. It is going to strike even healthy male and female workers in their prime. So men, for example, that are working in the mines, people that are working in the fields, people that are engaged in quarries and that are harvesting lumber. In all of these cases, there would be a proportion of the workforce that would have suffered, especially in places like mines. Let's just look at that, for example. These are, again, high density indoor areas. I mean, there are some outdoor mines as well, but for the most part, these are like small cities in some of these larger mines that were in Spain, for example, or in Dacia, what is now modern Romania. You got hundreds, maybe even thousands of workers in some of these facilities. When the disease came through and caused an outbreak in those areas, mining shut down, work shut down, and in some of these more precarious mines, the Romans were already in a battle with the water table. And so suddenly a work stoppage for a period of a month or two can get them in a position where it's very difficult to kind of unflood mines. I mean, it might only take that long to cause some chambers to be full of water. And what we see is a broad stoppage, or at least a pretty significant diminishing of mining activity around the 170s or so. So as this pandemic is really hitting its stride, we see mine workers and quarry workers and so on just effectively disappearing from the record, as well as their products. Now, what this means financially, let's just focus on the mines again. This is the main source of silver for Roman coinage. And suddenly, the emperors, Marcus Aurelius in particular, because he will live on, whereas his co-emperor Lucius Verus will die in 169, possibly of the Antonine Plague, in fact. But so Marcus Aurelius is by himself during the worst of this financial crisis. He does not have the coins to pay his soldiers because the silver mines have essentially shut down in numerous parts of the empire. So his soldiers are fighting an active war. They want bonuses. They're facing all sorts of dangers that they haven't faced in decades. And so Marcus can't pay them. And so this causes all sorts of desertions. Some soldiers just decide to start raiding other parts of the Roman Empire just to make some extra money because they're not getting paid by Marcus. So financially, it is a really precarious time. Marcus ends up even having basically a yard sale of all of the palace furnishings. He has his servants in Rome truck out a bunch of his furniture and his wife's clothes and, you know, drinking vessels, and they start just selling it in the forum to try to pay for the shortfalls that are occurring in the financial system. So it just keeps getting worse and worse during the 170s.
That doesn't sound like a great situation to be in, but as much as these are long-term consequences, at some point the plague ends, right? That surely would help, or maybe does it? Before we get into perhaps the longer-term consequences of the memory of the pandemic, when and how did it actually end?
This is another area where, even after writing a book, I'm ashamed to say I don't entirely know. We have really two possible end times. One is the more conventional ending, which is all the way to 190 AD. So this would be 25 years after the pandemic begins, from 165 to 190. And the evidence in favor of that interpretation is that there is a known disease outbreak in the city of Rome in 190. And so it seems quite easy to attach that to the Antonine Plague. Unfortunately, from my perspective, we don't know what disease broke out in Rome in 190. I mean, it could have been anything. We have no descriptions of what it did, apart from the fact that it affected both animals and people. So maybe that's the same disease, because we do have one source from the very beginning of the Antonine Plague, which also describes the disease affecting animals and people. So maybe that's the same disease, but that's not enough to give, to diagnose a disease. You can't can't really tell what disease that was. And there are lots of diseases that affect animals and people. And there are good reasons for ancient authors to say a disease affected animals and peoples, even if it didn't, because this suggests a kind of totality. There are other diseases in ancient history that were ancient history, even to the Romans, that were particularly bad that affect both animals and people. And so anyway, all this just to say, I know I'm getting into the weeds, is just to say that 190 is a plausible end date. I don't buy it because we don't see any evidence for the Antonine Plague after 175. And then there's a 15-year gap, and then we've got this outbreak in 190. Now, okay, maybe just the disease became so routine that nobody wrote about it for 15 years. I accept that that's possible. But Galen is still writing about it and is interested in it up until about the mid-170s. And it seems strange that he would just stop saying anything about it. It seems strange that we wouldn't find inscriptions that speak to people dying of this plague. It kind of dies out in the sources by name from about the mid-170s. So I favor that date. Now, don't get me wrong, just because I'm cutting 10 years, 15 years off the life of this pandemic doesn't mean it was still not devastating. A date from 165 to roughly 175 is still 10 years. We experienced a pandemic for about 3 years, and it was terrible, and we got very tired of it and sick of it. No pun intended. But imagine a pandemic lasting 10 years. And this was a sounds like a much more deadly pandemic than the COVID-19 pandemic was, as difficult and as challenging as that pandemic was for all of us. So this was a very serious pandemic that lasted at least 10 years and may have lasted as much as 25 years.
Wow. So what then are some of the ways you think this experience, given especially how long it was, how did it change people's perspectives? How did it change the way people saw the world?
This is a really important question, and really is a question that I myself would not have asked had I written the book at any other time in history. But because I started writing the book in March of 2020, and I was making sort of the final edits in mid-2023, after we had experienced, again, 3 years or so of pandemic, one of the things that became very clear to me about our own experience was that the disease, COVID-19, was just like the beginning of our pandemic experience. As bad as the disease was, we were all dealing globally with a whole bunch of new challenges and new questions. What does safety mean? What is science? What is information? And how can we get reliable information? What is expertise? What does that look like? How do we responsibly engage with a marketplace of ideas on the one hand, and also ensure that we're acting in a responsible way? Like, we had all these big fallouts from our experience with a pandemic disease. And the notion of pandemic was not still new to us. But for the Romans, this was the first time they had had a global disease outbreak that they could not escape, that elites couldn't escape from, that was sort of this sort of totalizing thing, even if it only lasted 10 years. And so what that means is, suddenly people are beginning to think globally in ways that they had not thought globally. If, for example, a disease could strike anybody anywhere, then this means that piety, for example, the mitigation, the natural mitigation for diseases in the Roman world, needs to be thought of as globally. And I don't think it is an accident that in the decades after the Antonine Plague, we see a real increase in syncretic religious views, in trying to sort of unify the Roman Empire in religious terms, in ways, and you know, where we see even emperors, now this is quite a ways later, but about 50 years later, mandating that everybody sacrifice to the gods and be able to provide proof that they have done this. I think even as the memory of the specific disease associated with the Antonine Plague, even as that historical event faded into the background and people forgot about it. What they remembered and what they continued to practice were some of those globalizing thought patterns and globalizing behaviors, such that they really began to conceive of global judgment and global outbreaks. And this would really help the Christians in some ways too. You get Christians being able to say now, hey, we've been telling you that there is one God. We've been saying that before you were saying that. And we've been telling you that this one God is preparing to judge everybody. Well, that's what's going on. And so it really foregrounds a lot of the most interesting religious debates, just to focus on one area, that took place in the decades after the Antonine Plague.
So much is interesting about this, kind of before, during, after, all of the different pieces. So thank you for taking us through it, even in this kind of highlights fashion, the book, of course, having so much more interesting detail. But before I let you get back to, I suppose, the real world, is there anything you've been working on since you finished this book that you'd like to preview or highlight for our audience?
Sure. One thing that I've been doing is a new podcast. So I've been taking some of what I've been doing in the classroom, just in terms of general Roman history, and I've been putting that in a podcast format, 15 minutes or so an episode every week, and that's called the Pax Romana podcast. So we're looking at this period called the Pax Romana, and that's been a lot of fun. So it's just some kind of public history stuff. And the other thing that I'm doing is I'm thinking about working on some sort of parallel book to Pax Romana. I'm not sure what there's no way I will ever outdo that title. That, in fact, I didn't come up with that title. It was the editor at Princeton came up with that title. But there will be some kind of companion book that will likely come out in a few years, which looks at the kind of nitty-gritty of the Pax Romana. One of the arguments of Pax Romana, the book, is that the Roman Empire was much more fragile than we think that it was, that its economy was fragile and its public health was not in a particularly good place, and that even the sources of its strength put it in some ways at some disadvantages. I really want to flesh out that idea. There are a lot of triumphant books that are written about the Antonine, or that are written about the Pax Romana, that kind of describe it as a golden age, an age of per capita economic growth, an efflorescent age, and in some ways it certainly was. But there, if we really examine it closely, there's a lot about that age that's more gilded than golden, and a lot about it that is far more rusty and a little bit precarious than many scholars have since, you know, have given it credit for. And so I'd like to spend a lot of time and again come out with a book that really explores a bit more of the seedy underbelly of Rome's supposed golden age.
All right, well, we'll have to have you back when that becomes a book, because that sounds fabulous. But of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World, published by Princeton University Press. Colin, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Absolutely, Miranda. It was wonderful to talk with you today.